Hello and welcome to Walkley Talks. I'm James Gorman from the Walkley Foundation for Journalism. Here we share discussions about the craft and importance of journalism in Australia and the world, often recorded at our events. This panel discussion will explore how regional journalism supports local communities, with examples of impact, advocacy, and campaigning journalism. What does the community lose if the local paper or news station doesn't exist? This panel will discuss examples of regional excellence and the ethical challenges for reporting in tight-knit communities. This talk was recorded as part of the Walkley Regional Journalism Summit on February 10.
Welcome back to the online Walkley Regional Journalism Summit. It has been a terrific morning already with some interesting ideas and perspectives from not just within Australia but around the world. I'm really looking forward to this next panel. It's going to be moderated by Rana Collins, who is a proud Palawa woman and the head of Indigenous News and Current Affairs at NITV and SBS. Rana works across a slate of digital and on-air platforms, a producer, a journalist, very strong editorial project management and strategic news background. Rana, it's over to you.
Thanks so much, Lisa. I'd like to acknowledge country, kick off by acknowledging country, the traditional owners from the country that I'm joining you from this afternoon, Bidjigal country in Tamarama in Sydney. And also I'd like to acknowledge any First Nations people on the call today and the traditional owners from all the places that you're joining us from. Today we are, of course, exploring how regional journalism supports local communities. And joining me on the panel today is Gabrielle Chan, the rural and regional editor of Guardian Australia. Gabby's been a journalist for more than 30 years, working across News Limited, the ABC and Guardian Australia. She has covered politics for both The Australian and The Guardian, and her essays have been published in Meanjin and The Griffith Review. Her book, Rusted Off, Why Country Australia is Fed Up, was shortlisted for both the 2019 Prime Minister's Literary Awards and the 2019 Walkley Book Award. Gabby has recently released a new book, Why You Should Give a F About Farming. Welcome, Gabby. We've also got Fiona Ferguson joining us today. Fiona is editor of the Northern Daily Leader. She's been with The Leader since 2016 and was previously a newsreader for Prime 7 in Tamworth. Rudy Maxwell, welcome, Rudy. Rudy is the editor of the Courier Mail, Australia's only 100% Aboriginal-owned independent national newspaper, based, of course, in Lismore on Bundjalung country. She has worked for the Northern Rivers Echo, the Northern Star, the Canberra Times and AAP. And last but not least, Donna Page is joining us today. Donna, of course, is an investigative reporter for the Newcastle Herald, where she has previously worked as chief of staff and day editor. She has worked for the South China Morning Post and Portuguese news agency Lusa, covering news and business. She has spent several years as an investigative reporter for a Chinese English current affairs magazine. And Donna has won Walkley Awards for coverage of community and regional affairs in 2016, 19, 2020, and was a finalist in 2013. She currently teaches journalism at the University of Newcastle, and that has been happening since 2016. Welcome to the panel. Really excited to be having this conversation today. Let's begin by describing the communities that we serve. Gabby, can I go to you first?
Sure. Well, for Guardian Australia, I serve basically the whole country, and hopefully we send some stories into the international arena as well. This project, the Rural Network, has only just started in August last year on a contributor-based model. So in some ways we're reinventing the wheel as we go in a very disrupted media landscape. But I guess over the years, I've developed contacts, particularly in writing the books and living in rural Australia for the last 25 years. And so it's a challenging balance between representing the local, representing the community, but reflecting nationally. So I would see our coverage as not obviously being able to cover every single story for every single community, but picking themes and having those local communities feed their stories into those themes so that people, the readers, get a better understanding.
Yeah, not a dissimilar challenge that we face at NITV. And Rudy, I imagine, based in Lismore but serving a national audience, did you want to talk about the community that you serve at the Courier Mail?
Sure, absolutely. And I also would like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which I join you from today, which is Widjibal Wyabal country of the Bundjalung Nation. So, yeah, similar to NITV and to Guardian Australia, we are a national newspaper, but we purely report on Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander news. So we do have correspondents in each state and territory. And we, similar to what Gabby was just saying, we do source news from different areas with view to often covering issues that are common amongst those areas. And I always describe the Courier Mail as a national community newspaper because we are very close to the people that we do stories with.
Yes, we're all so close to the stories that we're telling, aren't we? Donna, I might go to you next.
Yeah, sure. So I work for the Newcastle Herald, and I suppose for a lot of regional and rural communities, Newcastle's probably seen as a big city to some people. And as a fairly large regional community, you know, we cover local news. That's definitely our currency. And I would say that Newcastle is used as a bit of a guinea pig, I think, for some trials and programs and things along those lines. You know, we have, it's a very large area if you're looking at Newcastle and the Hunter region. We have, you know, pockets of social disadvantage, you know, and I would say that this region is always changing and evolving. Like one thing that we're facing at the moment is, you know, Newcastle's the largest coal export in the world, and we have thousands of people that work in coal mines in this region, and their transition with what's going on with coal and its future and all of that kind of stuff, huge issue for our region. And evolving.
And Fiona? We might come back to you, Fiona, and try to sort that out in a second. Let's talk about some of the key issues for each of the communities that we serve and what good journalism looks like for each of our publications. Let's go to you, Donna. We were just chatting to you about Newcastle, so let's just come back while we work on Fiona's audio.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, I think that as with any regional or rural community, localism, as I said, is at the core, and it always has been, of our reporting. I could make a list of things that I think are key issues for our community, but I think it's really important to note that the community really should be the people that inform those decisions, and that we, you know, at the Newcastle Herald, we try to listen to our community and report on things that are important to them. And so we don't set the agenda, we are hoping that they set the agenda. And that I think that good journalism in rural and regional communities is the same as good journalism anywhere, but I would say that there is a little bit more of a role for advocacy in regional and rural communities, because they can tend to get lost in the noise with decision makers and that kind of thing. And I think that, you know, good journalism for our local communities, it has to be relatable. So, you know, we have to break down, you know, local issues. You know, if we're not starting the debate, help inform the debate, you know, analysis, all of that kind of thing. And yeah, I just think that, you know, basically it should be driven by the community that you live in, and that's what I think local journalism is all about.
Definitely. And Rudy, we might come to you on the same question. So can you talk a little bit about the issues that are important to your audience and community and what good journalism looks like?
Sure. And again, similar to what Donna was saying, I agree that good journalism looks similar wherever you're coming from. For our readership, good stories and issues privilege Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander voices. So we never have non-Indigenous people speaking on behalf of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And the issues that are important are similar to all of Australia, but then obviously there are some that are specifically relating to Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And those issues might include things like deaths in custody, child removals, health issues. But when we're covering those issues, what we try to do is get away from what they call a deficit narrative. In some mainstream media, you will often see stories about Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people that focus very much on the negatives. And we try and avoid that as much as we can. And again, similar to what Donna was saying, we do try to let our readers and audience drive what we do. So it's very much a close working relationship with the people that we're reporting with.
Yes, nothing about us without us, not perpetuating any deficit narratives or stereotypes about our people. It's the way that we build trust and ensure that we are keeping relevant and speaking to our audiences in communities. Fiona, we've got you there. Would you be able to talk a little bit about the community that you serve at the Northern Daily Leader?
Sure. My apologies first up for the ineptness with technology. representing the Northern Daily Leader in northwestern New South Wales, based in Tamworth, so we're probably best known for our Tamworth Country Music Festival. But we're a pretty diverse community, rurally based, a lot of farming, a lot of trades, abattoirs, big industry. So for us, things like the 1-in-100-year drought we've just come out of are devastating for our community. So they really lead quite a bit of discussion coming into things like a pandemic as well. So we've had a really rough few years, as our local businesses would attest. So, yeah, we're a community paper. We are very much led by the community issues. We like to think we hold our councils and our politicians account. We are, of course, the home seat for our Deputy Prime Minister currently. So he provides quite some entertaining news at times. Yeah, so we're very campaign focused, issues based around water, industry, community.
Thank you. And, I mean, you've touched on it there, but regional journalism, you know, does provide advocacy for our communities at sort of all levels across the country, regional, rural and remote communities particularly. Do you have any examples of how your work has impacted the audiences that you serve, whether that's sort of pushing things forward or any other specific examples? We might go to you first, Donna.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I can think of lots of different examples from Joanne McCarthy's work that sparked the Royal Commission into institutional abuse. But I'll give you an example of a more local issue, because that had massive impact Australia wide. But the Newcastle Herald, we think we have a really good track record of community public service journalism, and so picking advocacy projects and following them through. And so generally they're written by everybody in the newsroom, whoever is, you know, around. Someone might be leading them, but we're working on one major one at the moment. But there's a beach here in a community in Newcastle, and it is absolutely been destroyed by erosion that is caused by the port, which makes, you know, so much money every year. It's ridiculous. The community has been fighting to try to get something done about that beach for probably 50 years. I went to a community meeting and I heard a guy from the OEH stand up and say, oh, I remember being here at a similar meeting to this 30 years ago. And so I went back to the newsroom, talked to the editor, and he said, let's get on this. So we started a community campaign to try to get something. The community has 4,000 people in it, and so they just didn't have a voice. And so basically it's been going on for years. We've written, I don't know, dozens, if not more than 100 stories. And, you know, there's been funding by the government to look at overturning legislation to allow for sand mining to re-nourish the beach. There's been millions of dollars spent on the beach. Like, we had two ministers here at the same time. Now, this community just never would have had that voice. It was, you know, all of the drone footage and the videos and all of that kind of stuff, it was made national news. And it was dogged relentless reporting on issues for communities that I think, you know, they're the kind of things that can really make a change, and they're really important. And this is just a really small community, and I'm talking about a beach, and I deliberately picked a really local issue, but it's really important for the whole region where I live.
And Fiona, are there any examples that you can sort of give us from the work that you've been doing?
Look, I can think of a couple. I touched on our community's sort of evolving a little bit before. We've got a university, the UNE, based in Armidale, and they've been looking to extend to build a campus in Tamworth. And it's, we didn't instigate the campaign, but we've certainly been a vehicle for that campaign to be voiced in our community and beyond, to get funding for a proper campus for the UNE to come to Tamworth. That's been achieved. That was over a number of years. More recently, and one that we've actually, and Donna was talking about blowing your own trumpet, I just can't help this, because Andrew Messenger, one of our journalists, has been nominated as a finalist for the Walkleys, based on a campaign that we did more recently on youth mental health. We have a Banksia mental health unit based at the hospital here. It's been due for an upgrade or a rebuild. And originally they weren't going to put any beds in for young people. So our young people were being bundled into the back of ambulances and taken to Newcastle for their mental health treatment, away from family and friends and all their support networks. And we didn't think that was good enough, and neither did the community. And so we've got on to that, really pushed that, got some documents that, you know, we probably shouldn't have seen or weren't supposed to see. And in the end, it's paid dividends, because they're going to have a number of youth beds, as well as an outreach clinical service for these young people in our town. And the young people are the future of this town. We can't ignore them. So we're really proud of that particular campaign to get those youth beds and youth services into our region, where previously they just didn't exist.
We've all got to be champions of the work that we're doing, I think, and we can kind of park a bit of that, I think, as we're answering these questions, because, of course, we're all working in the publications that we are because we believe in what we're doing there. Rudy, we're talking obviously about advocacy within the journalism and the work that we do at the different publications that we work for. Can you give me any examples at the Courier Mail?
Sure. We're not really a campaigning newspaper in the sense that Fiona and Donna were talking about, but what I would like to do is, I guess, draw attention to two stories that we broke that have had vastly different outcomes. So one of those is recent, and our newspaper broke the story about the copyright for the Aboriginal flag. So we were able to put that on our front page and then get it out there in the community. And while it wasn't campaigning journalism, we gave a lot of time and effort to speaking with the people who were running the Free the Flag campaign. And only a couple of weeks ago, after, I forget how many years now, 4 years, 3 years anyway, that issue has finally been resolved after a lot of behind-the-scenes work by National Minister of Indigenous Australians, Ken Wyatt, and presumably lots of public servants and other people too. So that one did have an outcome that I feel that our journalism, which I guess is more straight reportage, had an impact on. And then the other one I'd like to talk about is the issue about the Don Dale Youth Detention Centre in the Northern Territory, where we were one of the first publications, along with Guardian Australia and ABC Darwin and NITV, that brought attention to that issue. But despite all of our best collective efforts, that really didn't hit the national agenda until it was reported on by Four Corners. So I think sometimes that our voices for smaller publications and smaller media organisations can get aren't always heard by the people in decision-making positions.
Yeah, that's a really interesting point, and one that I was hoping that we could touch on, particularly as, you know, how there is a bit of a narrative around regional journalism being a training grounds to prepare for a move to a national masthead or broadcaster. But what we're talking about here is how important regional journalism is for the communities that we serve. How do we combat that? How do we combat you know, that moving on to bigger, better, when what we do is so obviously important to the communities that we serve. Gabby, would you like to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess break more stories, you know, continue to break stories that bring attention to the issues in a way that's translatable to both the audience and other media outlets that might not understand our various communities. One of the things that we wanted to bring was that real kind of accountability that often one of the things that annoys me about the way that a lot of companies and governments don't think about regional Australia at first glance, and you really have to pull hard and keep going back to them to try and get them to think about regional Australian issues. So, for example, like the unemployment figures, you know, you see the top line, you don't see the breakdowns. I think probably Donna at the Newcastle Herald could talk about, you know, the rollout of COVID numbers and how hard regional journalists were pushing to try and get breakdowns to understand in the early stages and some of the middle stages of the pandemic what was happening in those areas as well. So that accountability piece, the translation piece for people who may not understand some of the issues in regional Australia, and the reflective piece, you know, that often these issues that we're facing, our communities are facing, are reflective of wider issues that may not be considered. So I think finding a way to make people interested in what you're writing about that may be sitting in the middle of a city is just as important as telling the stories of local communities too, because Australia as a whole can move the issues, whereas sometimes we're considered, oh, well, it's just a smaller part of the population, so it's not really a big deal. And then in media terms, you know, I want to make the rural network a place where regional reporters can get starts and can continue and see that as a longer term career, not a stepping stone, as we often hear it translated, you know, in the national debate, you know, it's a good place to start. Well, no, it's a good place to stay and to continue and kick big career goals.
Can I interject and just say, I think as an industry too, we've got to take some responsibility for that, because for so long we've actually just said, oh, yeah, well, you're only here for a couple of years and then you'll move on to the big smoke and the big city. We've got to make ourselves employers of choice, and companies have to make those changes. And I think we're starting to see a little bit of that now, you know, with the training. It's a great first step, you know, the government's new package. It's a great first step, but there's a long way to go. You know, we need to better train our people while we've got them and make them want to stay. And so some of that responsibility falls on our own back, I think.
That's a really good point. Donna, did you want to add to this?
Yeah, look, I mean, I agree with what Fiona said, you know, career progression, things, you know, like being, you know, well paid and that kind of thing in regional and rural communities, they matter. That those types of things matter. So I think that, you know, companies, you know, have a role there in terms of providing ongoing training and all of that kind of stuff. But the one thing that I would say is that thinking of regional and rural journalists that all want to move to a city, I think it's a bit of a misnomer from people that don't live in regional and rural communities, because the thing is there are plenty of career regional journalists and rural journalists, as you said, many working for the ABC, you know, and once again, I'll refer back to Joanne McCarthy, you know, a career regional journalist who won the Gold Walkley Award, and her reporting spanned a decade, hundreds of stories. And so if she wasn't in a regional or a rural community, she wouldn't have been able to do that. And so there are brilliant opportunities for people that want to stay in regional and rural communities, I suppose, if that's where their passion leads them. And so I do think that, you know, the constant referral of, you know, oh, it's a stepping stone and, you know, you're going to move along. I think that, you know, it's not necessarily the truth. You know, Fiona, I'm sure you would say the same thing.
I think a lot of that comes out of the broadcasting as well, broadcast journalism. I think you'll find a lot more career journalists in print and online even, but broadcast journalists, a lot of the young people, all they want to be is, you know, heads on TV, and that's disappointing to a certain degree. I mean, I'm a 20-year, you know, 25-year veteran of regional journalism. I love it.
Same.
Yep. Place to stay. It's a destination, not a stepping stone.
Yeah.
But it presents its own challenges. So let's have a chat about the advantages and the challenges of reporting on the ground when you need to face your audience at the weekend barbecue or the local footy match. You know, how do you navigate this? How do you handle it? Let's start with you, Rudy.
So for this question, I should say, so I'm not Aboriginal or Torres Strait Islander, so I'm not a member of the community for this particular newspaper. So I'm going to draw my experience as a former editor of the sadly now defunct Northern Rivers Echo here in Lismore. And I loved that job because it was the masthead where I got my first start. And then I returned years later to be the editor. So I used to find even going to the supermarket meant that people would come up and give you their opinions, which is really great. And mostly people are really polite and want to have a yarn about something you've written, or, you know, even if they want to let you know that they disagree with something, it's actually a really nice interaction, and it really made me feel even more than I'd ever been before connected to my community, because people knew who I was and they were kind and generous enough to take the time to come and talk to me. So I did love that feedback part about it. It also taught me a great deal about responsibility in what we write. I've carried this moment with me for a number of years where up here about, I guess, 15 years ago, there was a terrible car accident where 5 young men were in one car and racing, and they had a serious accident and 4 of them were killed, but the driver survived. And, you know, it's a tragedy all around. And I wrote an editorial about exactly that, how it was a tragedy all around, but that the young driver had made a tragic, awful decision that he would have to live for the rest of his life, but that he deserved our compassion rather than our censure. And his dad wrote to me and said, thank you. It's very nice to have that published, acknowledged publicly. And I've always carried that with me as an idea in the back of my head that what I'm reporting on is real people. It's not an abstract idea. It's people who have family members, and that it matters how we present what we do, and it matters the choices we make every day in our newsrooms.
Yeah, so important, that sense of responsibility and accountability to our communities. Donna, I'd love to hear from you about this question.
I think that, you know, if you're fair, you're balanced, goes back to those key things, you know, that we subscribe to in the Code of Ethics. If you're fair, balanced, and you're humble when you make a mistake and you admit it, you correct it, I think that can help. It helps you to build relationships with people where they can look at you as being somebody that can be, you know, trustworthy or trusted, that kind of thing. And I also think that I always say this to my students at the university that and I have fallen into this before, and so that's why I tell them that you always should be really upfront and honest with people, so that there's no surprises when they open the paper the next day, or there's no surprises when they, you know, look at the story online. If you've been honest and upfront, then when you have to call them the next day, or when you run into them at the shops or whatever, then they're going to hopefully think that the exchange or whatever, it's genuine, and that there's no trickery involved, that you haven't done, you know, something that was underhanded. So I think, and the other thing I think about the proximity, and this is, I try to, and similar to what Rudy said, I try to look at it as a positive. Because if you run into somebody at the shops or you run into them at the netball courts or whatever, and they come up and they want to talk to you, well, my feeling is that you should listen, and that, you know, that hope, and so many great stories come from those environments, you know, like because you're not on your, you know, they're not on their normal guard. Things are more relaxed. And the other thing is too, if someone wants to give you a spray, then as long as it's within reason, listen, accept it. And the thing is, you're going to end up with better understanding, hopefully, between the two of you, and that has to be a positive thing for your journalism, and it has to be a positive thing for them. So, you know, every now and again, you just got to cop it. But I do think that the proximity thing, it should, for me, I see it as an advantage rather than a disadvantage, for sure. You need to take advantage of it.
Yeah. And Gabby,
yeah,
the Regional Reporting Network, be really interested to know how you navigate this.
Yeah, well, this is a big one. And in fact, my first book, Rusted Off, was really a look at my local community and the distance between a small town of 2,000 and the Australian Parliament. So that was a long-form journalism exercise where I really had to go to the supermarket and talk to the same people that I had interviewed on politics with often diametrically opposed views to mine. And could I get through that whole project with remaining friends and being able to see them? And that was a really interesting exercise for me. I mean, I just make the point that the worst things that have been said to me as a journalist have been on social media, not in my local community. People feel licensed to say a whole lot of shit to you on social media that people would never say in person. So I agree with Donna that, you know, often if you're going to cop a spray, then it might be for a reasonable reason, and so you have to listen to it. Having said that, though, I did have an experience when I worked at our local paper when the kids were little, and this lady came in and she was obviously cranky. I hadn't written anything about her, but she was worried because she'd had a sort of a bingle in the main street and dented her bumper bar that I was going to write something on it, and said, "Don't you dare write anything about me," you know, and I'm going, "Ah, I'm not interested in a bent bumper bar," you know. So people can be very worried about scrutiny, and I don't underplay the kind of dynamics that happen, particularly in a small town like mine, where, you know, there is a power hierarchy. There is reporting on someone in court from a very influential family in the district is going to be different to reporting on someone, you know, that doesn't have that power. So I think there are real issues that we have to negotiate. The biggest issues that I've had from the rural network's point of view is always land use, like the opposition support for a wind farm, opposition support for a mine, opposition support for some sort of development, agricultural development. I mean, that's, in my experience, that's where it gets really hairy.
Yeah, definitely. And you've all kind of spoken about the ethical and personal challenges that you face reporting on issues that are impacting the community that you're working from. Fiona, did you want to add to this?
I did. And it was only because it was just a quick comment that only a couple of months ago, one of the magistrates commented in court that being put in the paper was probably worse than any punishment she could actually hand out. So I don't know whether we took pride in that or not, but, you know, helping, yeah. I just thought that was a rather funny sort of addition to her speech to the convicted at the end of his trial.
We've got a couple of questions coming in from the audience, so I might jump on to one of these now. We've got one in from Corinne Podger. She's currently mentoring two regional journalists, one junior, one senior, through the WIMOZ program. Neither wants to move to a major city. They get good training opportunities and get to live near their families. Corinne says, "I feel we should be surfacing their experiences as success stories more often. How can we do this?" Any suggestions from the panel?
Do you mean their success stories as young journalists wanting to stay in a regional area?
Yeah, career regional journalism. How can we how can we use some success stories to help combat that narrative we were speaking about earlier?
Yeah, I think that's becoming harder and harder as we're losing more and more mastheads in regional areas. Well, I think great on them. That's really, really good. In my experience, I started in a regional area, went to the city and then have come back and never want to live in the city again. So in answer to the question about how we draw more attention to that, I guess it's a collective that we all have to kind of work together towards. And it may be that one of the upsides of the pandemic and that of people working remotely and in different ways, that might help us to be able to share stories of regional journalists who like living in the regions, as opposed to, I guess, this sort of narrative I've seen recently of people from the city kind of deciding to slum it in the regions or something, which I find deeply weird and offensive. But yeah, so I wonder if it's something about us working together and then also with the journalism schools, and obviously Donna can talk more to that.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think things like we're doing today really helps. And, you know, coming back to the Walkleys having a rural and regional and community, you know, award every year, I think that those types of things, you know, like they're really important. And also Gabrielle's program, like, I mean, we're talking here about, you know, getting well, you can talk to it, Gabrielle, I won't. You can explain exactly how that works and getting, you know, young journalists from rural communities and regional communities and getting their stories out there. So, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, our program is a contributor model where, you know, I'm the editor of the rural and regional section. I have a young reporter. We've teamed up with UTS to award some graduates places in regional papers, and all funded by the Vincent Fairfax Family Foundation to try and, you know, expand and help rural journalism. And the way it works is that we have a reporter in Gilgandra at the moment at the Gilgandra Weekly. She works for us 4 days a week. She works for that paper 1 day a week, paid for by our program. So the idea is to, I mean, I guess it's a bit like the doctor's program, where training in regional areas can sometimes demystify for people who may have been raised in a metropolitan area what it's like to live in a regional community and what you can do. So it's been really interesting because the contributors have been coming to me, you know, pitching stories. The idea is they pitch, they know their local area, they know what the main story is in their local area, and they can write it in a way that's nuanced, that's empathetic, but also they have, you know, the best contacts. They really understand the issues. And while it can present problems for them that we've talked about in the previous questions about how you balance all those competing interests when you live, you are of that community, I think it's a really valuable model, and we'll be putting more young journos into independent regional papers over the coming years. And I think it's been really interesting that some of the people that have been writing have very little experience in journalism, but they have something to give. And hopefully through a program like this, we can develop their journalism, give them confidence to go further in regional reporting. So I think it's been a really interesting exercise and a really successful one, if I do say so myself.
Another important point as well is funding for you know, like, you know, government funding, you know, the Judith Nielsen Institute, like funding for projects for regional journalism, that's crucial. Like, you know, I suppose in terms of, you know, letting regional and rural journalists be able to work on projects and things along those lines that they wouldn't normally get to, maybe not normally get the time or have the money to be able to do. And, you know, that so I think that the focus on so many jobs being lost in regional and rural areas, I think that it can only help. You know, the more spotlight that we put on, you know, the fact that this is a huge issue, hopefully, you know, we can sustain at least what we have, grow, you know, other outlets, grow media outlets that we've already got. Yeah, so we don't lose anything more because we can't really just can't afford to.
Continue to build and grow our network of regional journalists across the country. How can we tell these authentic stories without people on the ground to help facilitate that? Rudy, you've got a similar contributor model at the Koori Mail, you know, supporting Aboriginal journalists to stay on country, supporting non-Indigenous journalists as well based in regional areas to deliver to the Koori Mail. Did you want to talk a little bit about the program there at the Koori Mail?
Sure. Yeah, so because as I said earlier, we are a national newspaper, and obviously, as Gabrielle was saying before, the best people who are placed to do a story about a particular area are the people in that area. So we have a network of contributors, some of them regular, some of them pop up. We also do partnerships with other Aboriginal media organisations. So if we were after a particular story in, say, Roebourne, we would talk to NADA Media, who are the Aboriginal community broadcaster up in that part of Western Australia. Where we can, we do try to get people to talk to people on the ground. Obviously, that's not always possible. So I do have a very hardworking small team of reporters based here in Lismore, and we do a lot of phone work with our contacts. But yeah, where we can, we absolutely take content from people who, again, as we've been talking about all day, actually know what's going on where they are. Because it is about, I guess, all those themes that we've been talking about, the being close to your audience and your readers, that matters for authenticity and for getting the real story.
We've got a question in from Lisa Miller that I really wanted to touch on as well while I've got you all here. As a reporter in a regional area, Lisa talks about having, you know, a supportive team around her. So a newsroom, other journalists, you know, editorial leads. But now we're seeing reporters based in regional centres sometimes working alone, out of their homes, out of their garages, facing the same challenges relating to reporting on trauma, violence, car crash, door knocks. Are we doing enough to keep a check on the mental health for people in these sort of working environments and particularly heightened through COVID? Gabby, did you want to jump in on that one?
Yeah, I'm really aware of this, and I do actually miss, I love working from home, but I do miss that kind of newsroom camaraderie and just the ability to easily bounce ideas and questions and sort of just double check my judgments sometimes. And obviously you can do that electronically and over the phone, but there is a very different dynamic about it, I think. And I've thought about it a lot in terms of taking our young journalists, sending them out to areas that they're not familiar with. Our first reporter, Natasha May, is doing a great job from Gilgandra. But I'm very, you know, we speak numerous times in the day, and so that's how I keep contact, and we talk about all sorts of things. So I think it's something that managers of people have to be really aware of, because it can be really isolating depending on where you are and what your personal circumstances are. And I actually joked with someone the other day who's not working in journalism but another profession, the idea, you know, we're seeing this sort of growth of the co-working space, and I do have a space I can go to town, and they're not journalists but they work in other areas. It's a bit tricky when you're on the phone and interviewing people and other people are hearing your conversations. But I was joking, you know, maybe once for a week, a month, we could, you know, go somewhere, satellite, all get together and get that sort of camaraderie some other way. There must be a different way to do that. And the other thing I do is go to the office every so often in Sydney just to, you know, touch base, just really to get an idea of how that office dynamic is working and remind everyone, you know, what I look like, because otherwise, you know, you don't see people from week to week.
Yeah. Donna, did you want to jump in about that, keeping mentally strong and facing those challenging stories and what kind of processes or strategies in place to get through that?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that ACM, which owns the Newcastle Herald, instituted in the last 12 months was a ACM-wide mentoring program. And so basically, you know, junior reporters were, even if they were, you know, might be working alone or something, they were teamed up with somebody else. And so the idea behind that program is not only for sharing of, you know, skills and, you know, being able to assist, you know, somebody younger in terms of, you know, their reporting and that kind of thing, but it's also to check in and, you know, make sure, I suppose, that they're okay and how things are going. And if they might face something that's, you know, like extremely challenging or something, then they can talk about it and they can get some advice and that kind of thing. But Newcastle, compared to a lot of other regional and rural media outlets, we have a fairly large newsroom. But I will even say, and it's not large compared to what it used to be, but I would even say that, you know, like we do a morning news conference, and there's no doubting, and the editor has definitely raised this with us, that the idea sharing and the bouncing off you know, stories evolve. And so if you've got somebody in the room that might know something about it or whatever, that, you know, you can really benefit, the stories can really benefit. And that newsroom camaraderie definitely works. But if somebody that is working on their own, yeah, they really do need someone that they can check in with. Fiona might be able to address that a little bit better than what I can, for sure.
I was just going to mention the mentoring program, but also going to just we are a fairly young newsroom. The switching in and out of old staff and new staff coming in, so we are a very young newsroom. And I find that the younger journalists need that feedback, despite their prolification on social media. They actually really like the face-to-face contact. And we've had a couple of new starters who've come in while we've been working from home, and that's been challenging for them and for us. I know we have a morning meeting where we do, you know, the bouncing of ideas. We talk, often they'll go for an hour, and then we check in again of an afternoon, sort of mid-afternoon. How are you going? What are your stories turning into? You know, how are you feeling about it? All that. So it really is a matter of that toing and froing and checking in and just making sure you are getting in touch with people. I know our newsroom, though, is really looking forward to getting back into the office, even if it is for a limited sort of a couple of days a week, just to have that real personal. I mean, journalists are very, you know, face-to-face personal people. They love to have a chat, whether it's to the talent or to each other. So, yeah, that has been really challenging in this time particularly.
Sorry, Gabby, you want to jump in?
Yeah, I would just say that there's a question in there about, you know, do you do risk assessments before you send young reporters out on assignment? Absolutely, we check out where we're going to be sending reporters for longer term assignments like that. You know, I went up to Gilgandra. I think we're all very aware of that. We also do extra training, all sorts of training courses for journalists, you know, fire training, hazard training, you know, data, also relating to a range of things that journalists face. So I think all of those things are really important. And I've got to say, when I started in journalism in 1984, there wasn't much of that. In fact, there wasn't any of that, I don't think. So things have really changed, and I think editors and commissioning editors have become much more aware of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and we've got some pretty incredible resources that can support, as we've got a couple of comments coming in, the Rory Peck, the INCI, DART, of course, and the processes and strategies that we have to build resilience within, you know, within our journalists' cohort as well. So we've got a lot of tools at our disposal that we can sort of share as well more widely at the end of this session. We're quickly running out of time, but I wanted to touch on, you know, in regional centres, where do you find, what are your best sources for original reporting We'd love to hear from each of you on what are your go-tos for original stories. Donna, you look ready to jump in.
Well, I'm pretty old school, I have to admit straight off the bat. So I don't have a personal Facebook account. And so social media, I understand, is a huge, you know, can be a huge source for stories for journalists and that kind of thing. And I do use it to check some things every now and again and that kind of thing. But people, you know, like I could give you a million different examples. I catch a ferry to work. Every single person that works on that boat has got my mobile number. You know, we work in the largest coal port in the world. If something happens on that port, they ring me. So people that, you know, like that are in the community, like, you know, listening to people. And I just think that that's really crucial. Like, as we said, you know, if good, authentic local reporting is about building those relationships of trust. And I could bang on and on and on and on and on about it, but you know, don't sit at your desk. If you know, you can report a council meeting online really easy, but you're not going to get a story that that somebody else is not going to get. You're not going to get an original story from that. So and I understand time constraints, and there's no doubting that, but you really need at times to get out from behind your desk and get out and go and meet people and introduce yourself, listen to the, you know, like a wide network of friends, you know, like from doctors to nurses to truck drivers, and, you know, ask them about their grievances, about their work, their concerns, and just constantly be on the lookout for stories wherever you are. Like, you don't have to make a pest of yourself about it. Maybe some people would say that I do at times, but like just constantly be looking. There's stories everywhere, and the thing is, they come from people. And so building relationships with people, for me, that's where they come from, original reporting ideas.
Rudy?
Yeah, look, 100%. Everything that Donna's said and that everybody said during the course of this webinar, I'd agree with. But it is about building those trust relationships over time. So similar to what Donna was just saying, we get people contacting us. And because we've built up a reputation as a fair and reasonable reporting organisation, then people trust us. And so they do come to us with their good stories. And sometimes these can be really difficult topics to speak about. And so we take them very seriously, and we're very careful in what we do to make sure that we maintain that trust with the people that we do stories with. And I always say with rather than on, because for me, it's that two-way relationship, so that it goes back to what all the other panelists were saying today too, so that you can look your community in the eye and say, yes, we did a fair job. We did the best that we could in the time that we have.
Fiona.
The supermarket. I refuse to get home delivery because I just love to stroll around the supermarket. And there wouldn't be a time when I wouldn't go shopping and just don't get pulled up by people. And that's something that I say to the young journos too, go out and talk to these people, because you'll go out and do the story that you have, you know, the intention of going out to do, but you'll come back with five more just through a simple conversation. And people feel more relaxed when they're talking to you face-to-face. Over the phone is very impersonal sometimes. So.
Very true. And Gabby?
Yes, people, you know, it's a joke between me and my husband about, you know, he can see me sort of cock an ear when we're having a conversation with someone, and he says to me, not everything is a story, you know, like you don't have to treat everything like a story, but everything is a story, surely. So, you know, it's listening out to all of those conversations. Social media. I do use social media a bit, but I think all of us are probably at a stage of our careers where we've got a wide network of contacts and you're constantly touching base with them, and they, you know, you're developing that regular conversation so that you're the go-to when they see an issue in their community. They're going to think of you first, and that's how we certainly want to be seen. That, you know, we've recently done some extensive reporting on the Inland Rail. Well, that sort of sense of taking an issue seriously, I think, really starts to bring back benefits when people say, okay, I know these people are serious about this, so I'm going to go to them if there's an issue that I think needs to be aired. And, you know, the whole panel would have experienced that sort of thing.
Definitely, you can't put a price on a coffee or a run-in at your local supermarket. That's all we've got time for today. I'll hand the baton back to you, Lisa, and thank you so much to our incredible panel for your time and your expertise on this subject matter.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Walkley Talks podcast with me, James Gorman. You can find links to the stories mentioned in this discussion in the show notes. Sign up to our newsletter at walkleys.com/subscribe to be the first to learn about our new episodes, events, and other opportunities. If you've enjoyed this episode of Walkley Talks, you can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favourite podcast app. And while you're there, please take a moment to rate us. This podcast is produced by Andrew Herlinger with help from the 2SER studio in Sydney, Australia.